Within 2 years, 7 new evangelical Christian churches had been launched in Baghdad alone. Some credited their humanitarian efforts, but the Roman Catholic Archbishop claimed they seduced Christians from other churches, and some Muslims complained about the proselytization. Whatever the effect, many in the Christian right appear to have a larger purpose, perhaps related to preparation for the rapture, the tribulation, and Armageddon. Some 40% of Americans, as we have seen, believe that the Antichrist is alive and already on the earth. Paul Boyer dates evangelical preoccupation with the Middle East back half a century, stirred by the creation of Israel in 1948, then by the recapture of Jerusalem's Old City in 1967, and then again by the expansion of Jewish settlements in Gaza and the West Bank, all key end times signs. They further balloon during the years surrounding the Gulf War and the demonizing of Saddam Hussein. Islam's evil role, says Boyer, is an ancient view in Christian eschatology. As Richard the Lionhearted prepared for the Third Crusade in 1190, the famed prophecy interpreter Joachim of Fiore assured him that the Islamic ruler Saladin, who held Jerusalem, was the Antichrist, and that Richard would defeat him and recapture the Holy City. Later, even during World War I, the Ottoman Empire was cast in the Antichrist role, and by the 1970s, fundamentalists were transferring that evil to the Arab world. Anticipating George W. Bush, Boyer adds, prophecy writers in the late 20th century also quickly zeroed in on Saddam Hussein. If not the Antichrist himself, they suggested, Saddam could well be a forerunner of the evil one. Prophecy believers found particular significance in Saddam's plan, launched in the 1970s, to rebuild Babylon on its ancient ruins. The fabled city on the Euphrates, south of Baghdad, owed its splendor to King Nebuchadnezzar, the same wicked king who warred against Israel and destroyed Jerusalem in 586 BC. Evil Babylon, the antithesis of Jerusalem, the good city, prompted its own literature in the 1990s. And LaHaye's tens of millions of readers praised his series as making the Bible and its supposed predictions come alive. Like Boyer and other critics of LaHaye, I cannot help but think that by the early 2000s, certainly by September 11th, the Left Behind series provided an extraordinary context for a president with a religious mission. Its biblical framework already bundled together the terrorism of September 11th, the oil politics of the Persian Gulf, oil itself being, in the LaHaye books, a strategic calculus of the Antichrist, it could not be a White House focus, and the invasion of Iraq cum Babylon. The distinctions that mattered to secular Americans, that Saddam was not involved in the September 11th attacks and that the weapons of mass destruction excuse for invading Iraq was specious, would have mattered less to the tens of millions of true believers viewing events through a left-behind perspective. They simply embraced Bush's broad good versus evil explanation. Ultimately, polling projects have suggested that Bush backers were uniquely muddled in their perceptions. One special survey undertaken by the Center for International and Security Studies at the University of Maryland found three-quarters of Bush backers still convinced in autumn 2004 that Iraq did have weapons of mass destruction or a development program and was also aiding al-Qaeda despite well-publicized official reports to the contrary. As part of their worldview, these people simply refused to disbelieve Bush's original weaponry assurances or implications. A case of cognitive dissonance. Unfortunately, the international consequence of U.S. misjudgment in the Middle East, from the loss of American prestige and rising oil prices to occupied Iraq's role in breeding, not relieving, Islamic terrorism, could not be so easily ignored. The military casualties and the budgetary deficit effects of the imbroglio in Iraq rose together. And if the disarray was far short of anything in World War I, some of the message was similar. As in Britain, nearly a century earlier, evangelical religion, biblically stirred foreign policy, and a crusader mentality ill-fitted a great power decreasingly able to bear the rising economic costs of strategic and energy supply failure. If anything, the United States of the early 2000s, for all that it lacked Britain's established church, was under George W. Bush in the grip of a considerably more powerful religiosity, constituency pressure, and biblical worldview. Part 3. Borrowed Prosperity. Chapter 8. Soaring Debt, Uncertain Politics, and the Financialization of the United States. 30 years ago, neither firms nor politicians used, or could use, massive indebtedness to justify their actions or inaction. Since 1980, firms, politicians, and others have regularly used debt to rationalize conduct that has been damaging to workers and to the poor. Debt, directly or indirectly, has decayed the very soul of America. James Medoff and Andrew Harless, The Indebted Society. It's finally happened. Moving money around has surpassed making things as a share of the U.S. gross domestic product. But while the explosion of debt and credit is well acknowledged, in this context, the New York Times in 2005 employed the term borrower industrial complex. The benign phrase financial services still dominates the discussion. Even so, the armchair detective can easily figure out that we are approaching a national transformation in economic vitality that past world powers allowed to their peril. In official statistics, the finance, insurance, and real estate, FIRE, sector of the U.S. economy swelled to 20% of the gross domestic product in 2000, jumping ahead of manufacturing, which slipped to 14.5%. Since the 1980s, financial deregulation has encouraged these three related vocations to interweave in so many holding companies and financial groups that their identification as one sector has become routine. In a revealing introduction to the Financial Services Fact Book for 2005, Gordon Stewart, president of the co-sponsoring Insurance Information Institute, noted that a new chapter on mortgage finance and housing offered a fascinating glimpse into home ownership demographics in the U.S. and recent refinancing activity. Insurance, the investment business, and mortgage finance have become teammates. In this extended fraternity, the assets of the financial services sector rose from $37.9 trillion in 2002 to $42 trillion in 2003 and $45.3 trillion in 2004. The United States has a new dominant economic sector. Debt was a critical enabler. Its huge expansion, especially in the 1980s and 1990s, paralleled and helped to bring about the growth in U.S. financial services. This has become one of the most under-researched and under-analyzed dimensions of late 20th century U.S. economic transformation. As the collective weight of public and private debt ballooned between the Vietnam War years and 2000, the financial services sector essentially accompanied debt up the staircase. In the words of investment strategist Stephen Leeb, one key word says it all. Debt is behind the pulsating growth in financial services. Over the past 50 years, they have moved in lockstep as a percentage of GDP. Earnings added a further exclamation point. Financial sector profits shot past those of manufacturing in the mid-1990s, thereafter moving farther ahead. By 2004, financial firms boasted nearly 40% of all U.S. profits. The financial sector commanded a quarter of America's stock market capitalization that year, up from just 6% in 1980 and 11% in 1990. Historically, this transformation is as momentous as the emergence of railroads, iron and steel, and the displacement of agriculture during the decades after the Civil War. Several recent snapshots of financial services make a kindred point, that finance now outweighs, outmuscles, and outlobbies goods production. However unhealthy the financial services relation with debt, the explanations are straightforward. American financial services firms conduct much of their business in managing, packaging, or trading debt and credit instruments, as well as handling debt-related corporate restructurings. Lucrative returns have flowed from government and corporate bonds, asset-backed securities, credit cards, mortgages, and home loans, as well as financial and credit derivatives, like credit default swaps, leveraged buyouts, and a plethora of other gambits and gambles. Much as railroads proliferated needlessly and recklessly in late 19th century Britain and the United States, finance has done likewise in the 1980s, 1990s, and 2000s. Part of what propelled financial services were the profits gained from providing American households with artificial purchasing power. The loans that many took out to splurge on consumption or to restore income levels they could no longer attain from shrinking manufacturing or back-office wages. Financial firms in the credit business, and few major companies were not in it, generally marketed their credit cards through solicitations that held out low costs and instant gratification. By 2003, many were imposing fees and interest rates on unpaid balances that critics compared to loan sharking. These 19% and 25% interest charges might be a sweet spot on the ledgers, but anyone taking a larger perspective had cause for alarm. Historically, top world economic powers have found financialization a sign of late-stage debilitation, marked by excessive debt, great disparity between rich and poor, and unfolding economic decline. Financialization can be defined as a process whereby financial services, broadly construed, take over the dominant economic, cultural, and political role in a national economy. In his book, In Praise of Hard Industries, British journalist Eamon Fingleton deplores financialism as the increasing tendency by the financial sector to invent gratuitous work for itself that does nothing to address society's real needs, but simply creates jobs for financial professionals. My term describes only the broader cultural and national transformation. Ordinary citizens suffer most, but they usually lack the expertise to fully comprehend the changes underway. The thesis of Part 3 of this book is simple. This debt and credit revolution constitutes the third major peril hanging over the future of the United States. Debt has long been a tool of economic and political management. However, during its first century and a half, the American Republic confined serious borrowing bouts to meeting the demands of major wars, the Revolution, the Civil War, and World War I. The debt was often paid down quickly, sometimes abetting a major post-war economic contraction. Large-scale expansion of public debt was rare in peacetime. The U.S. shift to fiscal permissiveness came in two stages in the 20th century. In the 1930s, when the federal government accepted large-scale deficit spending in peacetime to fight the Great Depression, and then in the wake of World War II, when Washington decided against risking another post-war contraction. Instead, policymakers let most of the wartime inflation and debt expansion stand. Accepting a national debt that had risen to more than 100% of GDP seemed the lesser evil. Happily, that ratio fell rapidly. Prosperity expanded the economy, reducing debt's relative burden. Real problems held off until the late 1960s when President Lyndon Johnson accelerated federal spending to pay for both a widening war in Vietnam and pursuit of what he called the Great Society at Home. The 60s were the first named go-go years, and White House economists, convinced that sophisticated new management could transcend the business cycle, shrugged off the guidelines of careful accountancy and bet that the country could afford guns and butter simultaneously. These plans miscarried, and in a hint of worse to come, the federal budget deficit in 1968 climbed to $25 billion, or 2.9% of GDP, the largest since 1946. Foreigners became distrustful, especially after the United States in 1971 stopped letting foreign central banks redeem dollars for gold, as they had long been allowed to do. Senior U.S. economic officials were thereafter obliged to seek the tolerance of international and domestic lenders for large U.S. budget deficits, creeping inflation, or a combination of both. Their forbearance allowed American voters and major business interests to sidestep some of the unpleasant choices, most notably tax increases or benefits cuts, forced on unluckier fiscally loose nations. By the 80s, Democrats opposed serious spending reductions, while Republicans wanted to cut rather than raise taxes, and deficits rose accordingly. During the early 1970s, the budget shortfalls had been closer to 1968 dimensions. In the 1980s, they reached critical mass. $208 billion and 6.1% of GDP in 1983, $184 billion and 4.9% of GDP in 1984, $212 billion and 5.2% in 1985, and $221 billion and 5.1% in 1986. This time, Republicans rather than Democrats were seduced into permissiveness by supply-side economics and theories along the lines of the Laffer curve. Normally, domestic fiscal laxity on this scale has painful consequences. However, because the dollar was the world's reserve currency, the United States usually could more or less print the money it needed, and the rest of the world, after grumbling, would acquiesce. Many nations went along in part because they relied on the United States for other protection, military and economic. Washington's success helped to breed a policy and mindset that could be described as debtsmanship. How big a deficit could the United States get away with, and for how long? By the 1980s, the fiscal cauldron boiled as the Reagan administration, shedding the familiar Republican green eyeshade conservatism, began to employ economic strategies that went beyond debt tolerance to outright indulgence. Political as well as corporate wheeler-dealers perceived benefits. Could a bigger deficit be shrugged off if it enabled tax cuts? Might that deficit, having been enlarged for tax cuts, then be turned around to compel reductions in federal programs? In 1980, George H.W. Bush had famously described this thinking as voodoo economics, but he soon gave in. Old ideologies were metamorphosing. Religion, of course, has its born-again dimension, and sometimes economics gets entangled with it. As conservative politics accepted debt, elements of the population were embracing born-again Christianity, evangelical, fundamentalist, and Pentecostal denominations that drew ever more of the population into a preoccupation with personal salvation. Some preachers even promised economic fulfillment along with salvation. George W. Bush, struggling with his succession of debt-ridden or nearly insolvent Texas oil businesses, had found alcohol first, but then turned to God in 1986 as oil prices slumped to their $10 per barrel nadir. It may not be irrelevant to wonder how many other Americans took similar refuge, comfort, or inspiration as economic or cultural nooses seemed to tighten. The precarious trajectory of American debt. As conservatives embraced new forms of economic stimulus in the 1980s, new genres of supportive economic literature found an audience. Some thinkers equated capitalism with quasi-religious gift-giving. Others perceived hitherto unappreciated civic virtue in earlier ages' robber barons. Still others extolled the virtues of deficits that could curb taxation and debt that could unlock corporate assets for more profitable deployment. After a while, economic vice became economic virtue. Fiscal gunslingers became paladins of the new debt frontier. Novelist Tom Wolfe cast a Wall Street bond trader as a master of the universe, self-imagined at least, in his bestseller Bonfire of the Vanities. By mid-decade, the high-interest junk bonds pioneered by Michael Milken were being hailed as constructive levers of a more democratic capitalism. Liberal economist Robert Reich countered that paper entrepreneurs who reshuffled money and debt were replacing those who made actual goods. To some conservative economists, wealth inequalities could be ignored because what ordinary Americans truly cared about was consumption, their own ability to participate in the endless television advertising and credit card offers pouring out of Madison Avenue's American dream machine. "I shop, therefore I am," became a suburban motto and also a bumper sticker. The amount of consumer credit outstanding more than doubled between 1980 and 1990. Indebtedness flourished on many fronts, as a government artifice, a corporate tactic, an investment firm underwriting bonanza, and, for many ordinary citizens, a household indulgence or sheer economic necessity. The foundations of the 21st century borrower industrial complex were being poured. Although some federal deficit apologias had merit, more were flawed, often by their insufficient attention to the maturity of the U.S. economy. Historically, debt is constructive in emerging and adolescent nations, but perilous in those beginning to age or contemplate retirement. Take, for example, Alexander Hamilton's timely 1781 notion of a funded public debt as a fiscal boon, a national blessing. For a new nation with commercial aspirations, it might well be. The Dutch in the early 17th century and the English in the 1690s had pioneered funded national debts and found them essential for borrowing at reasonable rates of interest during wartime. Many generations later, however, as their public debts bloated and their national trajectories turned downward, Dutchmen and Britons in turn staggered under their heritage of lending, borrowing, and cultivating reliance on finance and rentier cultures. Debt ceased to be a blessing. Even Habsburg Spain had its own unique economic system that used gold and silver bullion from the New World to support bond issues and underwrite extravagant foreign wars. We will revisit those unhappy precedents in the next chapter. As the 21st century began, the United States was well into the dangerous part of the leading economic power trajectory. Finance had displaced manufacturing, despite Washington ploys to redefine and overstate the latter by including the output of hamburger emporiums and computer software. As the Federal Reserve Board pushed down interest rates between 2001 and 2004, consumer debt psychologies became increasingly reckless. One economist lamented that we're a what's-my-monthly-payment nation. The idea is to have my monthly payments as big as I can take. If you cut interest rates, I'll get a bigger car. At $7.8 trillion in 2004, although computations vary, the national debt, the amount owed by the United States to holders of its sovereign debt, was the largest ever measured. The credit-driven economy of 2003 to 2004, for its part, in turn provoked dismissal as a phony recovery because of U.S. dependence on possibly the biggest fiscal and monetary stimulus in history. In the meantime, yet another measurement, net foreign indebtedness, $3.3 trillion by 2004, up from roughly zero in 1987, confirmed the United States as the world's principal debtor. Yet the borrowing continued. Cynics joked about Washington having to wheedle $2.5 billion per day. Corporate debt was another mirror. Many companies used the deep Federal Reserve interest rate reductions completed in 2003 to refinance their debt. Even so, the quality ratings issued by Moody's, Standard & Poor's, and Fitch were lower and overall corporate debt levels higher than they had been in 1999. Not a good sign. By 2005, leveraged buyouts, the great corporate debt ploy of the 80s, were back in the news and fattening the risky loan totals. Record issuance of low-rated bonds prompted David Hamilton, director of corporate bond default research for Moody's, to observe that this percentage of really risky debt is unprecedented. Household debt, which includes credit card balances, mortgages, and other loans, was also of growing concern. By 2005, it had reached levels that made toughening of federal bankruptcy law, enacted that April, a high financial services industry priority. Courtesy of economists at Northern Trust, Goldman Sachs, and elsewhere, a few voters in 2004 had heard fleeting references to the household deficit, an unnerving portrait of how much more American households were spending each year than they earned. In 2004, they had laid out $1.04 for every $1 of income, falling in total some $400 billion in the red. That red ink, of course, required households so burdened to make it up by taking out loans or drawing down assets. To find comparable examples, Paul Kasriel, chief economist at Northern Trust, had to go back to 1946 to 1950, a period during which Americans spent pent-up savings left from the shortage years of World War II, when stores had offered little for sale. The 21st century pattern, by contrast, was better explained by the unprecedented decline of the U.S. personal savings rate over a quarter of a century. In 1980, Americans collectively put aside a net 7.4% of national income. By 1990, that had fallen to 4.5%, and by 2005, to a record low negative savings rate. The first steep rise in the U.S. accretion of its mountain of debt came in the 1980s. The 1990s then carried what economists call total credit market debt, government, business, financial, and household, above its previous top, 287% of GDP, in the era surrounding the 1929 crash. The transition from the stock market expansion of 1997 to 2000 into the subsequent credit and housing expansion raised the peak higher still. By 2004, total credit market debt reached 304% of GDP, the sort of Himalayan altitude generally associated with dizziness and nosebleeds. Just how worried the average American was remained unclear. Robert Marks, an enterprising New York economist, devoted a page in Barron's to an intriguing and disconcerting thesis: that by 2004, the unprecedented magnitude of credit and debt in the United States had made irrelevant the traditional focus of the Federal Reserve Board on the nation's money supply. Total non-financial credit market debt in the $23 trillion range, he argued, had effectively supplanted the $3 trillion money supply as the best guide to the actual economy. However unlikely to persuade the Fed, Marx's analysis made a strong case that the U.S. economy was regrouping around credit, debt, and the side currents of financialization. To carefully examine the pitfalls of U.S. debt, national, international, financial, corporate, and household, it is necessary to divide the overall bulk of the debt mountain into separate entities. But first, one more return to the decades before 1980 is in order. The debt mentality and problem did not just spring to life during the Reagan presidency. It gathered slowly, back in the 1960s and early 1970s, when debt creep was not yet seen as threatening. The national debt remained low as a share of GDP, while the usual small surplus in the current account meant that the U.S. international balance of trade in goods, services, and investments was still favorable, even though imported automobiles, steel, and consumer electronics were capturing a growing share of the American market. As for corporate debt, between 1960 and 1980, it soared, enlarged in the 1960s by funny money, the corporate debentures issued in a wave of conglomerate building and named for the possibility that they could become worthless if the conglomerate house of cards had collapsed. Corporations were still robust despite paying 23% of all U.S. tax receipts in 1960. By 1990, after many new bond issues and favorable tax provisions, that share slipped to just 9%. Household debt, while large and growing, represented the equivalent of only 50% of GDP in 1960 and 60% in 1980. This was well below the last binge levels at the time of the 1929 crash and its painful aftermath. Householders in the 60s and 70s were still somewhat constrained by memories of the Great Depression, which helped to keep the U.S. savings rate in the healthy 8% range. Even so, economic chronicles count the 60s as a yeasty decade. Credit cards, launched in the 1950s, came of age during the go-go decade, although shenanigans in the rebounding mutual fund industry are what furnished the nickname. Another clue was the attention that William McChesney Martin, that era's Federal Reserve Board chairman, got in 1965 for worrying about the 60s' resemblance to the 20s. The Dow Jones Industrial Average touched 1,000 for the first time in 1966, exciting stockbrokers, and the interaction of individual credit cards, television advertising, and ringing retail cash registers was as phenomenal as the effects of radio pitchmen and the introduction of installment buying in the 1920s. During the 60s alone, consumer debt increased by two-thirds. Mortgage debt, the largest individual ingredient of overall household debt, also ballooned from $208 billion in 1960 to $474 billion in 1970, and $1,465 billion in 1980, as Americans filled in suburbia and carried on to exurbia. State and local governments added their own new debt to the pile, notably for schools and roads. The point of this brief backward glance is to underscore that the 60s, four decades removed from the 20s, laid a vital foundation by reattuning U.S. economic psychologies to consumerism, stock market booms, and borrowing. In short, we must date the great 20th century U.S. debt and credit buildup back to that decade. It has now been 8 decades since the last major rock slide. Nevertheless, the 80s are when debt got out of hand, producing problems that hadn't even been thought of in the Coolidge-Hoover era. During the Reagan years, economists began to refer to the twin deficits, the federal budget deficit and the current account deficit. No domestic red ink stained the 20s because Washington ran successive budget surpluses from 1920 to 1930. The national debt had been paid down from $24 billion to $16 billion. Internationally, the United States in the 1920s had a very favorable global payments balance, as befitted both the world's number one creditor and a nation where exports far exceeded imports. When Treasury Secretary Donald T. Regan observed in 1981 that we're not going back to high-button shoes and celluloid collars, but the president does want to go back to many of the economic incentives that brought about the prosperity of the Coolidge period, fiscal prudence was the precedent he ignored. During Andrew Mellon's long tenure as Secretary of the Treasury, 1921 to 1932, Republican officials and economists pursued debt's reduction, not its expansion. Indeed, Mellon's weakness as the Depression unfolded was magnified by his impolitic statement in 1930 expressing utter lack of sympathy for debtors, farmers, or speculative investors, whose abuses could be liquidated to purge the rottenness out of the system. The Democratic presidential cycle that began in 1933 soon introduced willing use of deficitry and debtcraft, reflecting the spend-to-stimulate theories of John Maynard Keynes, whose view had become so widespread by 1970 that Richard Nixon acknowledged that we're all Keynesians now. In fact, the inflation of the 1970s was about to end Keynes's ideological reign. Yet many Republicans besides Nixon remained under partial influence. By the Reagan years, besides encompassing supply-side tax-cut theology and monetarist faith in currency expansion and shrinkage, the ranks of conservative Republicanism included tax-cut Keynesians. Deficits are fine if you're giving money back to the folks who count. Military Keynesians, the Pentagon houses government's most deserving function. Pork-barrel Keynesians, more roads and projects, and then even more, and even bailout Keynesians. Large or well-connected financial institutions have to be rescued. By the decade's end, as the philosophers of debt usefulness finished lining bookshelves with their paeans to junk bonds, leveraged buyouts, deserving deficits, tax cuts no matter what, and the belief that current account deficits signify only foreign hunger to invest in America, the debt fox was loose in the fiscal henhouse. Compared to the straight-laced Republican fiscal policy of the 1920s, the 1980s were a Roman orgy. By 1992, with the federal budget deficit reapproaching 5% of GDP and the infamous savings and loan bailout making daily headlines, citizen outrage energized the most successful independent presidential candidacy in 80 years, mounted by peppery Texas billionaire H. Ross Perot. Preaching against the dangers of debt and deficits, Perot urged a string of reforms that pivoted on an anti-deficit constitutional amendment and a long-term trade strategy focused on debt and jobs. The international economic supremacy of the United States circa 1960 was becoming a memory. By the late 1980s and early 1990s, Japan took over as the presumed threat. Smiling Tokyo billionaires were buying up trophy skyscrapers in Manhattan, along with what appeared to be half of Hawaii. Historian Paul Kennedy's 1987 book, The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers, crystallized attention to the idea that the United States might be on the cusp of great power decline. In 1988, Republican presidential hopeful Robert Dole had amended Ronald Reagan's 1984 claim that it was morning again in America. Now, said Dole, it was high noon. Time for the nation to face up to its global predicament, a point Perot and many others were to reiterate in 1992. Deficit foes, for their part, challenged debt apologists through a series of influential books. Beyond Our Means, 1987, by Alfred Malabre. On Borrowed Time, 1988, by investment banker and former Commerce Secretary Peter G. Peterson. Day of Reckoning, 1989, by Harvard economist Benjamin M. Friedman. And The Indebted Society, 1996, by economists James Medoff and Andrew Harless. Like Perot's, their indictments were unmistakable. Debt jeopardized the U.S. future. Yet the certainty about debt excesses was short-lived. Between 1998 and 2000, glum fiscal predictions appeared to wither on the vine as the technology-led stock market boom swelled toward its ultimate bubblehood. For a while, its luminance convinced many Americans, particularly investors, that prosperity and solvency had returned. Cassandras were awed into silence. Moreover, the stock market developed enough momentum that surging federal capital gains tax receipts washed away federal deficits. Unexpected federal budget surpluses replaced them in 1998, 1999, and 2000. Still buoyed by this, a heady George W. Bush, weeks after taking office in 2001, delivered State of the Union and budget messages proposing to both pay down an unprecedented part of our national debt and double our Medicare budget over the next decade. The principal caution was international. The rapidly expanding U.S. current account deficit, which combines the trade and investment flows. Briefly, a small surplus in 1991 as allies from Saudi Arabia to Japan reimbursed Washington for its outlays in the Gulf War, this deficit resurged during the late 1990s. To be sure, the simultaneous stock market boom facilitated soothing explanations. Powerfully, Americans were loading up on goods made elsewhere, but yes, foreigners were investing those dollars right back in soaring U.S. stocks. As for rising public consumption and its flip side, non-existent personal savings, that duality also had excuses. Did people need to save in banks when the values of their assets, stocks and real estate, were climbing like rockets? Wise or not, these were staple explanations. By the end of 2001, the world had changed again. The 1-2 punch of a stock market crash and a recession, followed by the trauma of September 11th, cut short any economic reveries. Slowly, painfully, awareness refocused on the nation's unresolved debt problems. By the 2004 presidential election, circumstances were worse than those 10 years earlier, aggravated by crises, financial developments, and White House missteps. Few people complained about outlays imposed by anti-terrorist demands and the war in Afghanistan, or about the Federal Reserve Board's 13 successive interest rate reductions that drove borrowing costs to a 45-year low by the summer of 2003. More skepticism, however, attached to the deficit-swelling tax cuts that principally benefited the richest Americans, the ongoing hemorrhage of manufacturing jobs, the higher-than-expected cost in lives and dollars of the 2003 invasion and occupation of Iraq, the related disruptions and soaring prices in the oil markets, and the accelerating 2002 to 2004 decline in the value of the dollar. The economic clouds were thickening again. Public and private debt levels bulked among them. As Federal Reserve Board Chairman Alan Greenspan merged his massive interest rate reductions with the Bush administration's tax cuts, the American people responded as Washington hoped. John and Jane Q. Public borrowed money cheaply and spent it liberally. All five U.S. debt colossi, national, international, financial, corporate, and household, kept setting records. At some points, even their momentum alone set records. The underlying Washington strategy, which succeeded in stimulating the economy, was less to give ordinary Americans direct sums than to create a low interest rate boom in real estate, thereby raising the percentage of American home ownership, ballooning the prices of homes, and allowing householders to take out some of that increase through low-cost refinancing. This triple play created new wealth to take the place of that destroyed in the 2000-2002 stock market crash and simultaneously raised consumer confidence. But the benefits did not end there. The lowest interest rates in four decades. The Fed's overnight funds rate dropped to 2% in early 2002, hit 1% in 2003, and stayed in between through late 2004, also revitalized stocks by 1, giving business cheap capital, 2, allowing debt-burdened corporations to refinance, and 3, motivating individual investors to buy stocks instead of leaving cash in money market accounts that paid negligible and even negative real interest. The Dow Jones Industrial Average, which had sunk from a peak of 11,700 in 2000 to 7,197 in 2002, regained some three-quarters of that loss by late 2005, although the shattered NASDAQ recovered only one-quarter or so of its huge collapse. As a result, $4 trillion of the $7 trillion shrinkage in stock valuation was regained, and rising home prices more than made up the difference. Nothing similar had ever been engineered before. Instead of a recovery orchestrated by Congress and the White House and aimed at the middle and bottom income segments, this one was directed by an appointed central banker, a man whose principal responsibility was to the banking system. His relief, targeted on financial assets and real estate, was principally achieved by monetary stimulus. This in itself confirmed the massive realignment of preferences and priorities within the American system. Such was Greenspan's success. But if debt expansion per se was one large gray cloud in the sky, the perception of a rebubbling of the economy was another. Nothing comparable had ever been tried. Critics such as Stephen Roach, Robert Shiller, and to an extent former Federal Reserve Board Chairman Paul Volcker argued in varying degrees that the effect of Fed policy was to inflate a new real estate and credit bubble on top of the older NASDAQ-centered froth. Roach, the chief economist at Morgan Stanley, described the Fed chairman as a serial bubble blower. By 2004, others spoke about an echo bubble or a double bubble, or even referred to Greenspan as chairman bubbles. The expansion of debt was huge, indisputable, and a topic of spirited national conversation. Likewise, huge and indisputable, but almost never discussed, were the powerful political economics lurking behind the stimulus. The massive rate-cut-driven post-2000 bailout of the FIRE sector, with its ever-climbing share of GDP and proximity to power. No longer would Washington concentrate stimulus on wages or public works employment. The Fed's policies, however shrewd, were not rooted in an abstraction of the national interest, but in pursuit of its statutory mandate to protect the U.S. banking and payment system, now inseparable from the broadly defined financial services sector. To this end, the 2001 to 2003 rate cuts extended a more than two-decade pattern, relentless under Greenspan, of slapping large green liquidity band-aids on any financial wound that might get infected. Large-scale peacetime government stimulus programs in the United States have always been partly political. The New Deal's elevation of labor unions, public works, and activist government in the 1930s, the unleashing by the Reagan administration of corporate and financial animal spirits in the 1980s. However, as the economist suggested, the Bush-Greenspan package, as history's biggest, dwarfed both. It also represents a bet, probably a gamble against human nature, on both the debt management capacities of the Federal Reserve Board and the public-spiritedness of the financial services industry. The emergence of the U.S. debt and credit industrial complex. As the relative importance and profitability of U.S. manufacturing and finance exchanged positions, a larger national transformation took place, akin to the upheaval in the 1880s and 1890s as railroading and manufacturing jumped ahead of agriculture in value added to the U.S. economy. In those days of agrarian despair, debt played a prominent role. It always seems to, in ruining overextended elements of the declining farm population while leveraging the ascent of the emerging industrial sector. Debt also has a well-known history of causing bubbles and periodic crises. By Bush's second term, the debt problem that had agitated the late 1980s and early 1990s had reasserted itself. The 1997 to 2001 return of budget surpluses became a mirage. Pessimists refocused their analyses on the long-term debt expansion arising out of the 1960s, 1970s, and 1980s. A graph for the 1965 to 2005 period of the critical debt measurements, public and private, domestic and international, would uncage a half-dozen climbing snakes, raising their heads for some sort of fiscal strike. The data are apples and oranges, but the problems are unmistakable. The accelerating displacement of U.S. manufacturing by the financial services sector, as we have seen, goes far back, greatly antedating both the late 1990s stock market bubble and the terrorist strikes of September 11, 2001. Since those events, however, the evolution from physical production into debt craft has accelerated alongside Washington's resort to massive stimulus of consumer borrowing and home refinancing. Debt and spending became fiscal patriotism, a way to strike back at Al-Qaeda by supporting the U.S. economy in the automobile showrooms, mortgage offices, and shopping malls. Just before the 2004 election, columnist Daniel Gross caught the new spirit of this rate-cut Keynesianism. The message since the September 11th attacks has been a strange and occasionally dissonant message of patriotism and consumption. As New Yorkers flocked to Ground Zero to volunteer, Mayor Rudolph Giuliani exhorted Gothamites to patronize Tribeca restaurants. President Bush appeared in ads urging Americans to fly and stay in hotels. These days, it seems, they also serve who spend like there's no tomorrow. Whereas during both world wars, government posters beseeched Americans to save and buy U.S. bonds, now the media relayed a different wartime imperative. Uncle Sam wants you to borrow. Taking advantage of zero-rate auto loans or refinancing your house was joining the nation's response to terror. Never before have political leaders urged such large-scale indebtedness on American consumers to rally the economy. Debt has not previously been held out as a solution to a nation already overburdened by it, especially one vulnerable to restive global creditors. Moreover, it is difficult to believe that the rise of finance, the relative decline of manufacturing, and the polarization of incomes and wealth in the United States can be reversed if political control continues to pass to rentiers and credit vendors. Think on the differences between the two sectors in income distribution. In the heyday of manufacturing, from the 1920s to the early 1970s, wave after wave of unionized blue-collar jobs lifted tens of millions of Americans into the middle class. Today, the American financial services economy pushes in the opposite direction. Its narrowing employment base, some 8 million in 2004 out of a national workforce of 131 million, contrasted to the much broader uplift of manufacturing in, say, 1960, when goods production employed 18 million Americans out of a workforce of 68 million. This, too, is in keeping with the later stages of previous leading world economic powers. Finance distributes its concentrated profits to a much smaller slice of the population. Although any estimate must be subjective, some 30 to 40% of the manufacturing workers during the 1960s, unionized, high-wage men for the most part, would have belonged to that era's emerging blue-collar middle class. At the top of the pyramid, some 50 to 100,000 or so senior manufacturing executives had compensation enough to put them in that era's top 1% income group. Yet in the manufacturing companies of that era, even chief executive officers made only 25 to 40 times the pay of a median production worker. By contrast, as finance consolidated its hold in the 90s, corporate CEOs made 300 to 500 times the pay of a median employee. Compared with the relative egalitarianism of manufacturing in the Eisenhower and Kennedy years, the smaller workforce of the contemporary financial services industry includes a much larger ratio of high earners, probably 8 to 10 times as many per thousand, whose $500,000 or over incomes put them in the top 1% nationally. The shrinking blue-collar middle class is the glaring casualty of the new regime. But a considerable percentage, with more to come, of yesteryear's white-collar employees, secretaries, clerks, statisticians, and telephone operators, also face losing jobs to computers or high school graduates in Hyderabad or Malaysia. Since the late 1970s, the loss of manufacturing jobs in the United States has pulled down inflation-adjusted wages for non-supervisory employees. At the same time, huge income and assets gains in the top 1 to 2%, where investors, financial services professionals, and wealth holders cluster, have enabled these percentiles to pull up overall national growth and income figures. The effect of this is to disguise the shrinkage elsewhere. By credible calculations, the top 1% of Americans in 2000 had as much disposable after-tax income as the bottom 100 million, or 35% of the population. Thus, talk about the average American income is innately misleading. Many economists explain these circumstances in impersonal terms, invoking technology, productivity, and education. These, however, miss another vital dynamic. The realignment of national interest group influence and the escalating political clout of the financial services industry. By the 1990s, policy favoritism had become epidemic. In The Indebted Society, economists James Medoff and Andrew Harless advanced a central argument claiming that as debt burgeoned in the United States in the 1980s, it also realigned political power. It is inevitable that lenders become more important in a society where debt becomes more important. Therefore, it seems likely that lenders also become more powerful. When lenders become more powerful, they have more influence over policy, and the policies chosen naturally reflect that influence. Citing the importance of banks, investment firms, mutual funds, and other elements of the financial services sector, Medoff and Harless noted the rise in the share of national income represented by net interest from 1% in 1950 to 5% in the early 1970s and 10% in the 1980s. By the early 2000s, however, debt colored so many transactions that its proceeds entailed a much wider range of rewards than straightforward interest. The term borrower industrial complex, cited by the New York Times and coined in a paper by economists Noriel Rubini and Brad Setzer, caught the magnitude of the U.S. sector, led by credit card operators that had grown up around borrowers and their needs. Use of the term debt and credit industrial complex would be more descriptive. Candor about the escalating political influence of lenders, investors, and the financial services industry has sometimes been colorful. In 1993, James Carville, an advisor to President Clinton, remarked that if he could be reincarnated, he'd want to come back as the bond market because it was so powerful. Referring to his 1993 economic proposals, Clinton himself said, "You mean to tell me that the success of the program in my re-election depends on the Federal Reserve and a bunch of effing bond traders?" In 1998, the financial services industry successfully mobilized to repeal the Glass-Steagall Act, the New Deal statute mandating the separation of commercial banking, investment banking, and insurance. According to the Center for Responsive Politics, the FIRE sector laid out more than $200 million for lobbying in 1998 and contributed more than $150 million in the 1997 to 1998 election cycle. Indignation from the left and elsewhere tended to be drowned in cheers for the soaring stock market, but its bubble popping re-legitimated criticism. In 2000, the exposés in the Buying of the Presidency and the Buying of Congress series, published by Charles Lewis and the Washington-based Center for Public Integrity, invariably dwelt on finance, its clout, and political access. Between 1990 and 2002, the FIRE sector repeatedly topped the list of contributors to national elections, giving more than $1.3 billion. In fact, the 2000 to 2001 fall of high tech only clarified the sectoral triumph of finance. Some of the sector's political enthusiasm was specific to the Bush family. In mid-2004, the Center for Public Integrity tabulated the leading lifetime patrons of George W. Bush. The Big Four were Morgan Stanley, Merrill Lynch, PricewaterhouseCoopers, and MBNA, the credit card giant. The family's background also blended these same origins and commitment. No presidential clan has been so involved in banking, investments, and money management over so much time. As the younger Bush's second term began, the pervasiveness of debt and credit in the U.S. economy drew increasing attention. Beyond the familiar center-left economic critique, the argument that creditors and lenders by nature dislike rapid growth and inflation, preferring lesser economic momentum, 2.5 to 3%, and the deflationary influence of cheap imports and a third world labor pool, broadened concern attached to the perception of a credit bubble. If housing prices weren't the second bubble in the Greenspan sequence, debt was. If there's a bubble, it's in this four-letter word. Debt, Merrill Lynch chief North American economist David Rosenberg had observed earlier. The U.S. economy is just awash in it. Other worriers ventured kindred descriptions. The credit bubble, the mortgage finance bubble, the hedge fund bubble, and the systemic liquidity money supply bubble. The underlying premises were similar. Debt and credit had gotten out of control, even as the rest of the economy sometimes seemed to flirt with deflation. Data from the 2000 census documenting the ascent of financial services became available in 2001, but received little initial public attention in a nation shell-shocked by the events of September 11th. The ominous linkage between the escalation of private and public U.S. debt and the expansion of the financial services industry was generally ignored, despite its imminent relevance when debt and home refinancing became such a conspicuous Washington priority. Investment strategists could be outspoken with important clients, but few officeholders held a similar 2004 dialogue with voters. In the words of Ray Dalio of Bridgewater Associates, a large Connecticut money management firm, "The money that's made from manufacturing stuff is a pittance in comparison to the amount of money made from shuffling money around. 44% of all corporate profits in the U.S. come from the financial sector, compared with only 10% from the manufacturing sector." I have seen no rebuttals. The numbers were hardly shocking. Public finance is one of the world economy's oldest profit centers. Research by the Wall Street Journal for a millennial retrospect on great wealth holders revealed public finance, the opportunity to handle the taxes, borrowings, and debts of kings, popes, and conquered provinces, as a major source of great fortunes since late medieval times. Notables included Jacques Coeur, financial advisor to 15th-century French kings, and the Peruzzi, Medici, and Fugger families, whose relations to power centered on popes. Three of the great British and French fortunes of the early 19th century were amassed by loan makers to governments. Nathan and James Rothschild and Gabriel Julien Ouvrard, the French wartime speculator and paymaster for Napoleon. Even in the early American Republic, four men counted among the richest, Robert Morris, William Bingham, Stephen Girard, and John Jacob Astor, owed significant portions of their wealth to investment or speculation in state and federal bonds and securities of the Bank of the United States. Accounts of late 19th century public finance and wealth echo with names such as Jay Cook, J.P. Morgan, and George F. Baker of New York's First National Bank. Today, despite the prominence of money men such as Warren Buffett and George Soros, the importance of the financial services industry rests less on glamorous individuals and more on a perverse interplay of magnitude and jeopardy. The magnitude lies in how finance has penetrated every nook and cranny of the U.S. economy, as well as the digitized world of cyberspace. From corner ATM machines and an average of 8 credit cards per household to a $15 trillion stock market, $40 trillion of total credit market debt, and a global total of derivative positions estimated at $270 trillion, the reach of finance is awesome. And as beyond our ken, as awed New Yorkers found the first electric dynamos in the 1880s. If history teaches us anything, it's that this so-called cutting-edge finance is an accident waiting to happen, despite claims by the so-called new macroeconomists that derivatives are tame and benign and that national debt and deficits are manageable within a new global savings pool in which national boundaries no longer matter so much. Even Alan Greenspan occasionally owned to uncertainty about where speculators and new credit instruments, hedge funds and derivatives in particular, might be taking the country. Throughout 2004 and 2005, investment strategists and economists speculated that Greenspan was nervous about these markets. Some even interpreted his May 2005 speech, citing the growing risk to banks and investors of a derivatives-driven liquidity crisis, as a thinly veiled message to sell. Their practical fear, that a rout in the bond market could follow any panicky hedge fund selling of collateral debt obligations, CDOs, mirrored uneasiness on the edge of the credit bubble. The evidence of the last four centuries is that financial innovation and intensity regularly breeds debt and credit crises, burst bubbles, and the like. In his still unsurpassed 1978 study, Manias, Panics, and Crashes, Charles Kindleberger listed 24 between 1720 and 1974 to 1975. Their parenthood was principally Dutch, British, and later American, because these nationalities dominated global finance, central banking, markets, and trade during those years. The first modern financial mania collapsed in 1720, the South Seas bubble, and the most recent, the high-tech NASDAQ bubble, splattered between 2000 and 2002. If human nature has changed, the gene modification must have occurred almost overnight. The economists who called Greenspan a serial bubbler or condemned him for throwing money supply or debt expansion at every crisis had documentation. Tabulations of M3, the broadest major money supply measurement, showed a mushrooming from $4 trillion to $7 trillion between the early 1990s and the millennium as Greenspan lubricated crises involving Mexican debt, Russian debt, Asian currencies, the collapse of long-term capital management, and Y2K fears. The Fed chairman's legitimate rebuttal rested on his responsibility for the safety of the banking system, although he discharged it well beyond any clear mandate in protecting non-bank linchpins such as long-term capital management, the large wayward hedge fund on behalf of which Greenspan helped arrange a Wall Street bailout in 1998. Indeed, the quarter century before 2005 could be described as a triumph of financial sector protection over marketplace comeuppance. The principal U.S. governmental interventions, resuscitations, and rescue missions, high-level influence was a given and huge dollops of money commonplace, were used to preserve financial sector interests and institutions. In the early 1980s, as these bailouts were getting underway, debate raged in Washington over a national industrial policy or strategy. That objective, originating with high technology companies, was for Washington to support U.S. firms against the mercantilist alliances of business and government prevalent in Europe, Latin America, and Asia. Otherwise, said U.S. executives, American manufacturers would lose more global markets. Conservative office holders and theorists generally disagreed, insisting that Washington should not pick winners. However, by the end of the century, it became clear that the federal government had done exactly that, picking finance to be the ascendant sector in the U.S. economy, and figuratively shrugging as American manufacturing lost its markets, profits, and prime political access. The electorate, of course, never got to vote on a decision that never had to be made formally. The financial sector, in fact, was already the statutorily designated constituency of Washington's second most powerful officeholder, the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, whose mandate was to supervise and regulate banks, implement monetary policy, and maintain a strong official payment system. Here, the reader may want to turn back to Chapter 6, with its portrait of how U.S. manufacturing slid and finance took control, staking the American future on a sector with no record of sustaining earlier global economic hegemonies. The Federal Reserve Board was the principal architect. So backstopped, the ascendant financial sector enjoyed the best of two seemingly contradictory worlds. On one hand, the Federal Reserve Board and sometimes the Treasury Department were available to rescue banks, bondholders, critical currencies, and even hedge funds too big to fail. Yet at the same time, the financial services industry enjoyed the accumulating benefit of three decades of deregulation, minimal regulatory constraint. This triumph of neo-laissez-faire, as we will see, was almost as important as the government bailouts. Deregulation of financial services had been underway since 1980, but by the late 1990s, the industry was like a long-distance runner coming down onto the flats for the last mile. The finish line, the promise of nearly unfettered financial capitalism and devil take the hindmost, was so close the panting chief executives could see it. Debtor Society, Credit Card Nation. In jeopardizing the Commonweal, through teenagers bearing credit cards, financiers leading politicians on golden leashes, and the Republic drowning in debt, the new economy mocks the dicta and beliefs of the nation's founding fathers. We can only wonder which one would have been most appalled. George Washington, who in the early 1770s decried London creditors for their treatment of Virginians, Benjamin Franklin, who deplored debt, John Adams, who publicly loathed banks, or Thomas Jefferson, who feared the rise of a financial elite. Lincoln, who put labor ahead of capital, would have been equally displeased, and likewise the two Roosevelts, Theodore and Franklin. Even the lessons of Greece and Rome were relevant, as the men deliberating in 1787 had known from their readings. For leading world economic powers of more recent vintage, the ins and outs and ups and downs of debt have been high-stakes rites of passage. If world history can be examined through the experience and saga of sugar, coal, spices, codfish, or technology, as bookshelves testify, debt also provides an important lens. One such volume, A Free Nation Deep in Debt, The Financial Roots of Democracy, recently came from a British investment banker, James McDonald. After explaining the role of debt, principally over the last 500 years, McDonald concluded that the rise of a massive, impersonal, and electronic global marketplace, public and private debt, had all but dissolved the old nexus between citizen creditors and democratic government. The emergence within the United States of the world's first large-scale debt and credit complex, analysis of which McDonald did not pursue, may tell an even sadder tale. A detailed chronicle of U.S. debt travails, looking back from 2015 or 2020, may rank the early 2000s as crisis years surpassing the 1890s, 1931 to 1933, and the early 1980s. During 2003, household debt jumped 11%, and 28% of Americans ended the year by giving debt priority in their New Year's resolutions, according to a poll by the Cambridge Consumer Index. Amelia Warren-Tiagi, co-author of The Two-Income Trap, Why Middle-Class Mothers and Fathers Are Going Broke, told reporters that nearly one-third of bankruptcy filers owed an entire year's salary on their credit cards. During 2004, one unlucky American filed for bankruptcy every 15 seconds. Antoinette Millard of Manhattan, after running up bills of nearly $1 million in local luxury emporiums, sued American Express for improperly soliciting her to sign up for a big spender's credit card. By year's end, consumer debt represented a record 85.7% of GDP. Overall, the U.S. economy had added $2.7 trillion in debt in 12 months. 2005, in turn, saw the household debt service ratio reach 13.4% of after-tax income, the highest level since the Fed began publishing that data in 1980. In California, interest-only loans accounted for 60% of new mortgages, up from 47% in 2004. Multiple causes were at work. Human nature provided the greed and gullibility at which three decades of determined federal regulatory dismantling had unleashed credit vendors. U.S. financial overseers, in turn, were disinclined to establish social criteria or community welfare yardsticks for economic policies or activities. Finance also indulged one of its periodic compulsions to combine avarice, legal nonchalance, and clever innovation in the new speculative instruments. Another sequence of the high-wire acts and bubble-blowing kits so recurrent in the four-century history of financial manias, panics, and crashes. How the U.S. federal government became willing to dismiss memories of the 1920s and start deregulating banking and finance in the 1970s and 1980s makes a logical entry point for risk assessment. The stripping away at old safeguards in the name of the marketplace was relentless. Consider these post-1970 policy milestones, some taken from the Financial Services Handbook, but others added from explanations of relevant court rulings and Federal Reserve Board decisions. In 1971, Washington stopped letting foreign central banks exchange their dollars for gold, thereby creating a buildup of excess U.S. currency in Europe, the advent of eurodollars. This supercharged the foreign exchange markets. In 1974, the U.S. government convinced Saudi Arabia and OPEC to price oil in dollars, which to some extent put the U.S. dollar on an oil standard. Many so-called petrodollars received in oil payments were invested through U.S. banks, recycling some of the benefits of higher oil prices. In 1978, the U.S. Supreme Court decided in the Marquette case to deregulate credit card interest rates. Practically speaking, a carte blanche that enabled credit card companies to set up in states, South Dakota, Delaware, et al., willing to allow full freedom. 2 years later, President Carter signed the Deposit Institutions Deregulation Act, voiding the 5% limitation on the interest rate that banks and savings institutions could pay, likewise a precondition for future innovations. In 1984, the Bank Holding Company Act was relaxed to allow banks to hold entire companies as if they were a portfolio of investments, even if they didn't perform banking-related functions. Permissiveness only broadened in the 1990s. In 1996, the U.S. Supreme Court held in the Barnett Bank case that banks could sell insurance. A second ruling that year, in Smiley v. Citibank, allowed credit card issuers to charge any fees, penalties for the most part, permitted by the states in which they were based. Within a few years, fees would begin to multiply like rabbits. In 1997, banks were allowed to buy securities firms. In 1999, after the Federal Reserve Board had already approved a merger between Citigroup and Travelers, a major insurance company, the policy of allowing such mergers belatedly became official with the enactment of the Financial Services Modernization Act. That same far-reaching statute also repealed the Bank Holding Company Act of 1957, establishing a new category of financial holding companies, FHCs. These could not only hold banks, securities firms, and insurance companies under one umbrella, but were also permitted to include non-financial enterprises. The 1995 to 2000 period had already seen a stunning crescendo of bank mergers, 11,100. Within a year after passage of the financial services mega deregulation, 500 new FHCs were created. This sequence, a powerful facilitator of the 1997 to 2000 stock market bubble, simultaneously gave the financial services industry essential wherewithal to consolidate its gains in share of GDP and soon to displace the toppled technology sector as the leader in U.S. stock market capitalization. For all that financiers lost huge sums of paper wealth in 2001 and 2002, the underlying realignment of the U.S. economy remained in place. Portions of the 1990s deregulation, it should be noted, rested on sound enough logic. Chairman Greenspan and others believed that the United States, handicapped by an old state-by-state banking structure rooted in Jeffersonian suspicions, required instead a phalanx of U.S. superbanks able to leapfrog state lines and abandon the 1930s ordered separation of banking, investment, and insurance in order to compete with giant financial conglomerates in the Japanese, British, French, Swiss, and German mold. By 2003, three of the world's top 10 banks were indeed American, up from none in 1988. The downside, unfortunately, was institutional hubris. Three U.S. banks became superbanks: Citigroup, the world's biggest, and the Bank of America and J.P. Morgan Chase, ranked further down. Compared to their predecessors of the 1980s, these institutions were powerhouses, Goliaths with units that ran the gamut from insurance and merchant banking to consumer credit. However, as these giants flexed their new muscles, the public interest was often squeezed. Witness the record of Citigroup. In late 1990, Citigroup was close to insolvency because of bad real estate and foreign loans. However, Citigroup's size made it essential to any global strategy for U.S. banking, and Federal Reserve officials helped to arrange a cash infusion and rescue by Saudi Prince Al-Waleed bin Talal. By 2004, the firm's new global primacy was matched by its lead in transgressions and large government fines. Name any scandal of the last decade: Enron, WorldCom, Parmalat, biased stock research, and Citigroup's name will crop up, concluded the Times of London. Conspicuous abuses outside the United States included a 2004 effort to rig the European bond market and a wayward private client operation in Tokyo that was shut down the same year by the Japanese government. Within the United States, the bank's most notable chastisements included $215 million to settle Federal Trade Commission charges of applying predatory lending techniques to poor and unsophisticated borrowers, along with a $2 billion fine for allegedly colluding with Enron in defrauding investors. As part of Citigroup's agreement to pay the $2 billion, however, the company was allowed to deny the wrongdoing alleged. Despite their size, such fines resembled hypothetically giving John D. Rockefeller a mere $50 million fine back in 1905, say, without making him admit the misbehavior of Standard Oil. No behavior would change. Just as in oil's emerging years, so much money was moving around within the swelling financial sector. Citigroup's revenues in 2004 topped $86 billion, that the practical effect of seemingly huge fines was hard to measure. Much of the new financial galaxy was barely regulated. For a year, Citigroup was able to flaunt a merger with Travelers that violated the Glass-Steagall Act, which was still on the law books. Enron, in turn, gutted potentially inhibiting regulation of its own futures trading through the good offices of Texas Senator Phil Gramm and his wife, Wendy Gramm, who chaired the Commodity Futures Regulatory Commission until she retired and joined the Enron Board of Directors. Greenspan, as chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, declined to take action against an apparent speculative bubble in the stock market, while central banks elsewhere in the world, the European Central Bank, the Bank of England, the Bank for International Settlements, considered that pricking such bubbles might be in order. As we have seen, in 2002 to 2003, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, within the Treasury Department, used its regulatory authority over bank credit cards to block activist regulators at the state level. Cole Porter's 1934 hit, Anything Goes, could have returned to Broadway with new lyrics. One disenchanted banker summarized the jurisdictional anarchy that followed the 1999 passage of the Financial Services Modernization Act. Financial holding companies got a regulatory green light to own any kind of financial service company, as well as investments in companies that had little or nothing to do with finance. They became catch-all structures to mask risky investments in non-bank corporations. Another festering problem created by the Financial Services Modernization Act was so-called functional regulation. The act claimed that each component of these new conglomerate institutions would be regulated by a different governmental regulatory body. This meant that different federal and state entities had oversight for different components of the same business, yet nobody had full oversight for the entire institution's activities as a whole. So, functional regulation could more appropriately be called dysfunctional regulation. Some of what we think of as the bubble of 1997 to 2000 was a side effect of massive, permissive deregulation, not just of finance, but of energy and telecommunications, both in